From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now. 2 years ago in Aurora, Colorado, 23-year-old black man Elijah McClain died in police custody after he was put in a chokehold and injected with a powerful sedative. Now, a new state report finds that Aurora Police and Fire Rescue have routinely violated state and federal law. Here's Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser.
These actions are unacceptable. They hurt the people that law enforcement is entrusted to protect, and they destroy community trust.
Now we have Allison Sherry, justice reporter with Colorado Public Radio. And Allison, what do we learn in this report about who tends to get arrested in Aurora and what force is used?
Yeah, so, you know, state investigators found that Aurora police has engaged in racially biased policing and used inappropriate force against residents for the last 5 or so years. And I have some numbers here I'll go through quickly. Yeah. They found that use of force against people of color was used almost 2.5 times more than whites based on their relative percentage of the population. And nearly half of the people whom they used force against were black, even though black residents make up about 15% of the population. The other thing that this report found is that Aurora police arrested people of color 1.3 times more than whites based on the population.
Wow. I mean, those numbers are striking. I look quickly at this report, which is pretty comprehensive. It also goes into paramedics. We know that in Elijah McClain's case, the paramedics injected him with ketamine, the sedative. The autopsy was inconclusive as far as he died, but what does this report say about the illegal use of ketamine by first responders?
Yeah, because of McClain's death, the agency has halted its ketamine use. But investigators found that in the year before that, paramedics administered ketamine 22 times for this condition called excited delirium. And in more than half of those incidents, paramedics failed to follow ketamine monitoring protocols, like watching someone's heart rate, watching their breathing after they gave him the sedative. Investigators also found, and this happened with Elijah McClain, that they administered ketamine at times at doses way above the maximum allowed for that weight of the person. So weight is a big deal when you're administering ketamine, and they weren't getting the proper weight before giving them the dosage.
Yeah, why? And does this report go into the why here? Why this pattern and practice of illegal behavior? Are there kind of cultural reasons in the police and fire rescue here?
Yeah, you know, you mentioned cultural reasons, and I think that's a big part of it. It's hard to kind of get at whys in a police agency. But this report did talk a little bit about police training, which I thought was interesting, how the training academy for the Aurora Police Department has recently made a ton of changes. But before that, it was a little bit militaristic in style. The cadets were assigned quote-unquote battle buddies. They were yelled at, personally embarrassed for mistakes. They're not doing that anymore, but clearly a lot of people who came up and are current officers there went through this sort of, you know, training culture.
All right.
And I also think they've had a lot of leadership changes. They have a brand new police chief. A lot of the more experienced officers feel like there's been some mixed messages at the top.
All right, that's Allison Sherry, justice reporter with Colorado Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Allison recently talked with McClain's mother, Shanine McClain, about the ways her life has changed since she lost her son. Her report adds depth and context to these latest developments, so we'll hear that now. And a warning, some of the descriptions in this story are disturbing.
When Elijah McClain's death started becoming national news, many people expected his mother, Shanine McClain, to take a leading role in the protest movement against police violence. But she's clear that's not her path.
I'm not that kind of person, you know, to get on the bullhorn and lead a bunch of people down the street trying to fight for rights that we shouldn't have to fight for.
Still, in the 2 years since her son's death, she's become a force for change, both in Colorado and nationally.
For me, it comes down to the policies and the laws.
Shanine McClain's nightmare started the night of August 24th, 2019, when police in Aurora, Colorado, stopped her son as he was walking home from a convenience store after buying iced tea.
A caller told police they saw a suspicious man wearing a mask waving his arms at them.
When McClain didn't immediately follow an officer's commands, he was tackled to the ground, put in two carotid holds that cut off blood flow to his brain.
He says a crew with Aurora Fire had to give McClain a sedative to calm him down, and that on his way to the hospital, he suffered a cardiac arrest. Paramedics say he regained his pulse and is now at the hospital.
At the time, Shanine McLean was homeless and living in a hotel with Elijah's siblings. She says police contacted her that night on a messaging app and said they needed to come get her, but refused to say why.
So they came to the hotel that I was at, and they put me in one police vehicle, and they put my two children in another police vehicle, and there was a police liaison, or the victim's advocate was there also. And when we got to the hospital, it still took another hour or so for them to let me see Elijah.
When she finally did get into his room, Shanine says Elijah wasn't in good shape. He was hooked up to a ventilator and had bubble wrap around his torso. His head was swollen, and there were tubes and machines coming out of his nose and mouth. His eyes were open a little, but not alert.
He didn't like rap music at all. His brain was not registering with the rap music at all. But once it got to violin and things that he was already into, it was a steady wave of his brain chemistry.
But after several days, doctors declared McLean brain dead and took him off life support. In the months following her son's death, Shanine McLean was achingly lonely. She held vigils near the spot where he died, a patch of weeds by the highway, which she decorated with little solar lights and artificial flowers from the dollar store.
As a single mom, doing everything I could to ensure that Elijah had a future so that he wouldn't end up a statistic. And then him being a statistic anyway felt like the world had rejected us, you know.
She hired a lawyer, but says there was more talking and media attention and interviews than actual change. She hadn't talked to anyone at the Aurora Police Department since the hospital. She didn't know where things stood. At that moment in 2019, the broader public was not focused on police brutality or violence.
Colorado was quiet. The politicians in Colorado were quiet.
That changed in the summer of 2020 after George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis.
You know, after George Floyd was murdered, there was a lot of internet searches, so to say. People started finding out that there was other people that were killed by police officers that didn't get that much attention as George Floyd. And so Elijah's name started circulating a lot more.
Shanine says finally people were listening to her son's story.
I was on Twitter, I was on Instagram, I was on YouTube, I was on Facebook, just, you know, pushing Elijah's murder story out there. And there was a lot of people that connected. There was a lot of people that connected via social media.
And many of them wanted to help somehow. McLean had started a GoFundMe a year before to help with funeral expenses, but had pretty much forgotten about it after that.
One of the activists, because apparently they were watching the GoFundMe more than I was, but one of the activists told me to look at the GoFundMe, and when I checked it out, it had $2.5 million in there.
Shanine McLean has been able to get stable. She bought a house outside of Aurora and a car. She also gave money to homeless organizations that helped her and her family through the years. Her son's notoriety continued to skyrocket across the world.
So when Naomi Osaka wore Elijah's name on a mask, that was awesome. When the coach from the Denver Nuggets wore Elijah's name on his shirt, that was awesome.
But the increasing attention also felt like she had lost control of her son's story. Protesters were using her son's name to promote causes that had nothing to do with him. She was getting cold called daily for donations from the GoFundMe. She discovered someone who had printed his last words on clothing and was selling it on Amazon.
So anybody who's profiting literally off of my son's murder are totally gross. And it's not just in the form of trying to make money off of his death. It's in the form of trying to use his name to gain notoriety for their own organizations, for their own events.
While all this was going on, Shanine McLean was getting active, not in the streets, but at the state capitol. She began to work on police reform legislation, a huge bill to ban chokeholds, mandate body cameras, and make it easier to hold officers personally liable. It was mostly inspired by her son's death and passed the Colorado State Legislature last year with wide bipartisan support.
It was emotional because I was told that they weren't able to pass that bill before Elijah's murder. And I think to myself, if that bill had to pass before Elijah's murder, Elijah would still be here.
Shanine counted this work as a victory, and she's kept at it. She's in frequent touch with Colorado Congressmen Jason Crow and Joe Neguse, working with them to pass federal police reform legislation that includes a ban on the powerful sedative ketamine's use during arrests. She filed a lawsuit against Aurora for her son's death. In the meantime, the new Aurora police chief has asked Shanine to speak to a class of incoming police officers.
I'm thinking about it, like I would have an opportunity to impact future police officers. It would be nice to think that they'll do the right thing, but they haven't been. You know, as a whole, they haven't been.
2 years after his death, Shanine McLean still talks to Elijah. She says sometimes when she's chatting with him, the television will come on. She says she doesn't have friends anymore, and she doesn't have much peace. But she does have a strong calling to make sure her son's life meant something, and that it will make the world better. For Here and Now, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
Across the country, school bus drivers are in short supply. In Wilmington, Delaware, for instance, last month, Eastside Charter School offered parents $700 if they would drop off and pick up their kids for this school year. In Massachusetts, Governor Charlie Baker is mobilizing 250 members of the National Guard to drive buses in some districts. For more, let's bring in Carrie Young, education reporter for member station WBUR. And Carrie, why are so many bus drivers absent?
Well, there are a couple things going on here, I think. In 2020, when school buildings shut down, there were a lot of drivers who were furloughed, and so a lot of people took that opportunity to retire. So that cut down the workforce there. And then also, a lot of bus drivers are older, and this year with the Delta variant and other political like debates going on over masking and vaccination policies, many people didn't want to take the risk. So you've got that too. And then when it comes to recruitment and rebuilding that workforce, that's been hard because you can't just hire workers on the spot for this. They need commercial driver's licenses and safety training and things like that. So it just takes time.
But National Guardsmen, I mean, it's probably not what members of the National Guard were expecting to be called for. What does their training look like to drive these buses?
Yeah, I mean, the governor's office tells us that the guardsmen who are going to be taking these assignments already do have the licenses they need for these vehicles. And it's also important to note that they're not just going to be jumping into those yellow school buses. They'll be running smaller vans that typically transport students with disabilities and special needs. But even that's complicated. You know, I mean, I talked to a couple of principals and school leaders about this week, and they're kind of torn about the idea. They're glad to have the help. But at the same time, you know, they're worried about, you know, whether or not they have the experience with working with this type of student population, students with intellectual disabilities or autism. So I think there's a lot of logistics and safety-related questions that still need to be answered.
Right, and if this is not a permanent solution, I mean, how is the state planning to attract more bus drivers?
Well, right now, I think a lot of that is happening on the local level. You have a lot of districts offering signing bonuses and paid training time, and others are going all the way of, like, making these full-time positions and adding benefits. So districts are trying all kinds of things right now and seeing what sticks.
Carrie Young is WBUR's education reporter. Thank you so much, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
In small towns and big cities throughout our country, thousands of people are starting over. They're refugees who have made it out of Afghanistan. The Department of Homeland Security estimates about 49,000 have arrived so far with nothing more than the clothes on their backs. The vast majority of them are being housed at 8 military bases across the country. And this week, President Biden began notifying governors of how many refugees will arrive in their states. And many more, as we know, are still waiting to get out of Afghanistan. Those are the people Wahidullah Asghari is thinking about, because this time last year, he was one of them.
I was at risk. I was thinking that, so if I do not go to the United States, maybe one day the U.S. troops will leave Afghanistan, and what are we trying to do? Maybe the same thing as it happened right now with everyone in Afghanistan.
For several years, Asghari was a translator for the U.S. government. In 2019, he applied for a special immigrant visa and boarded a plane for the U.S. as his wife stayed behind to wrap up their lives in Afghanistan. That meant Asghari had to travel on his own with four children in tow, including a baby boy named Mirage, who was just 1 year old.
It was a challenging time for me. It was really tough to handle all the kids. You know, they have a lot of responsibilities with the doctor and appointments and the school things, all these stuff, right?
You have to change it. Okay, how is it now?
I met up with this Gary on a sunny afternoon at his apartment in Burbank, California. The kids had just gotten out of school, and it's a new and exciting routine for them. Last school year, without knowing any English, they attended virtual classes. Six-year-old Mudassar was eager to watch some TV, as Gary's wife was trying to get their youngest down for a nap, and the twins, 9-year-old Musawer and Mina, were eager to play. Here's Mina.
I like to play hide-and-seek or tag. Hide-and-seek and tag, and I like to play runner.
A typical, uneventful day in the U.S., exactly what Asghari says he's been dreaming about for his children.
Their future is really bright. As I talk to them there, so maybe one will be a doctor, one will be an engineer, and one will be a teacher, right? Any profession they like.
But it's sometimes hard to focus on their future. He spends most of his nights on the phone with his mother and father and his brother, all of whom are still in Afghanistan. They talk about all of the other Afghans who desperately want out but can't leave.
Each one of them, males and females, old and young, they are thinking about, we want to leave the country because of lack of security they might face and their life is at risk. And they are thinking about just trying to go and live and start a new life, especially maybe in the United States or other countries.
Backpacks you see here, donated. We're going to be distributing those.
Miri Whitehill was one of the first to welcome Asghari and his children to America last year. As the founder of the nonprofit Miri's List, based in Eagle Rock, California, she's the person that greets refugees with a big smile and a welcome box in her arms.
And they're all brand new, really cute, on trend. Bright, happy colors.
Inside of that box is a lot of stuff some of us take for granted, like how-to lists in both Farsi and English, which gives instructions on how to get a driver's license, how to register your kids for school, how to get a COVID-19 vaccine. And then there are the personal touches, like the letters. Lots and lots of welcome letters from people all over the country. Each box gets one.
How about this one? Hi, welcome to the United States. And by the way, this one has very intricate cut paper all over it. She says, welcome to the United States. It takes a lot to move somewhere from far, so you should be proud of yourselves. I hope you like your new home.
These are beautiful, and I'm sure it holds additional meaning for you because you get to see, you know, the experience that these folks are about to go through, where they came from and what they're about to experience here.
Absolutely. This is the human touch. So come on back. I'm going to show you this one.
Whitehill takes me back to her garage where there's a row of boxes waiting for a letter to be carefully placed on top. She wants to make certain the letter is the first thing the Afghan families see when they open the boxes.
If I wasn't wearing a mask, all you could see was my million-dollar smile. That's just the best part of this job. I get to see people at their best. I meet people who are in the mode of giving, and also I meet people who are in the mode of being willing to make themselves vulnerable and make a new friend.
Whitehill started this effort back in 2016 after a friend told her about a new family from Syria that needed a few basic things like a baby bouncer. This galvanized her to do more. And today, Miri's List is one of many the State Department calls on as part of a larger collective to help families resettle around the U.S. On the week that I met her, Whitehill had a lot on her mind. She had just received a record number of referrals.
We are one organization. Miri's List is 5 years old. And although we have already helped 620 families in that 5 years who are living across 21 states nationally, that is nowhere near what the need is on a national scale, and certainly nowhere near a drop in the bucket compared to what the global need is for support for people who are moving around the world fleeing violence and persecution and cannot return home.
White Hill actually sees the arrival of Afghan refugees as an opportunity for America to, in a way, start to heal itself from the political and social divides that have caused so much pain in our country. And she thinks that healing starts with simple acts of kindness.
Last week, I had a phone call with just the nicest guy. He's an Air Force commander here at the LA Air Force Base. And he said, I'd really like to write some welcome letters to your families with the other military families on our base. Is that something that we could do through your organization? And I said, absolutely, because that is how we form deep connections and bonds.
Wahidullah Asghari now works for Miri's List. It's the perfect job for now, because he gets to teach what he knows, what it's like to start over.
If someone tries something, he can do it. But the families, including me, who came from Afghanistan, they came with nothing. They have got no money. They have got no clothing. They have got, you know, they are zero, including me. I was, the first time, I was a little bit, you know, I was stressed out. What am I going to do right now over here? There's a big change. Can I run my life here? So these are the challenges we most face and are still facing. And we hope that it will be ended soon.
California is projected to take in about 5,200 Afghan refugees. That's more arrivals than any other state. Some of the resettlement efforts, however, according to the State Department, have been stalled by a measles outbreak at some military bases. In Washington, D.C., fencing has gone up around the Capitol building, and police have requested National Guard backup ahead of a rally on Saturday that is meant to show support for right-wing activists facing criminal charges for rioting on January 6th. But NBC News disinformation reporter Ben Collins is reporting that the chatter on the internet among right-wing groups is, don't go to Saturday's rally. Ben, what is this chatter online about? Why are supporters of these rioters talking this down?
They think it is a false flag event. They think any violence that happens there will be perpetrated by the federal government. Very basically, they believe that there are what they call glowies, which are federal informants among them. And they think that they are infiltrating their message boards, their Telegram accounts. And invariably, they think that they are either hosting or have taken over this rally in some way. So they're telling people to stay away.
This is being organized by a former Trump campaign staffer, but most Republican lawmakers are distancing themselves from it. How big do you expect, with all of this information, how big do you expect for it to be?
Well, the federal government anticipates about 700 people to show up. It's unclear if that is what will happen. A lot of people have said they're doing it in a way to protest even the idea that they can be stopped in any way. So it's hard to know who's going to show up. That said, Many QAnon and militant influencers in these spaces, for example, people like Lynn Wood, the QAnon influencer, who was big in the Stop the Steal campaign, he told people just not to go, that it's not worth going. There are Proud Boys Telegram accounts saying the same thing. They're saying, don't show up. So it could be dozens of people, it could be hundreds of people. We just don't know yet.
Right. Authorities, though, are setting up as if they're prepared for violence. I mean, what have you heard in the chatter?
So basically, the rhetoric in these spaces is more violent than ever. They are priming each other to commit violence. The revolutionary zeal has not gone away from the days before the 6th. The difference is the planning is fundamentally very different. In the days before the 6th, you would see maps of the Capitol, the tunnels beneath the Capitol. You would see people posting pictures of their ammo that they brought to D.C. with them. You're not seeing that now. That's not the same thing. You're seeing things in the abstract calls to violence, people egging each other on to do violence. But it's not the same, I guess, master plan they had on, say, January 4th or January 5th.
You know, the bigger question is, if this isn't where activists' efforts are focused, what is their energy going to?
Well, there are many different disparate causes that have popped up. Mostly recently, it's about vaccine mandates. They are extremely upset about the fact that they have to get the vaccine to do things like go to restaurants in some cities or even hold down a federal job. Fundamentally, they believe that it's a government plot, that it's either microchipping you or it's tracking you in some way, or it's done to depopulate the planet. That is a big thing in their spaces. So instead, they've turned to alternative medicines like ivermectin and things like that. That's where most of their energy has gone. But they're still upset about things like the 2020 election. They're still awaiting results from this scam audit that is happening in Arizona. There are a bunch of different threads that they're following, and they're waiting for things to drop, basically.
Ben Collins covers disinformation, extremism, and the internet for NBC News. Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you think kids are playing too many video games, well, so does the Chinese government. It's limited online gaming to 3 hours per week for anyone under 18. And now Beijing is also slowing approvals for online games to fight what it considers addiction. It's all part of a broader strategy by the Communist Party to manage family life and the tech industry. For more, we have NPR's Emily Feng in Shanghai. And Emily, give us a picture of gaming in China. I've been there. You live there. It's hard to explain to people far away how pervasive this is.
You probably remember from your time in China that people, even a few years ago, were already addicted to their mobile phones. They're always swiping, prodding, playing mobile games, sometimes even while driving.
Yep.
So it's prevalent in all age groups. But it's also really frustrated parents because they see children who are distracted, who are not going to class and concentrating on their education. And so that's in part what prompted this video game ban.
Yeah, and can you tell us a little bit more about what seems to be Beijing's motivation here as far as this broader social goal? I mean, I've heard, you know, in my time there and your time there, there's often talk about spiritual pollution and that kind of propaganda. But what's your sense of the real social goal here?
Part of it is curbing this real problem. We have this in the U.S. where people are addicted to social media and the internet. It's the same in China. Only in China, they've taken much more draconian measures. There were already limits on what kind of games people of a certain age could play. Now they're taking that to more of an extreme by asking people to register for all mobile games and gaming parlors with their identification. And if you're under the age of 18, as you mentioned, you can only play between the times of 8 p.m. and 9 p.m., 1 hour a day, and you can play for one extra hour on holidays. Mm. So Beijing has not only redirected the attention of their future workers, their future citizens, but they also have kind of kneecapped some of the very, very powerful tech firms that had been accruing a lot of money through selling these sometimes violent, sometimes slightly lewd games to teenagers.
All right. And this rule comes amid other big moves. The government has also gone after private tutoring companies trying to narrow their space in the economy, another gigantic industry in China where most Chinese parents either pay for tutoring for their child or want to. So when you kind of put these together, what's the broader idea here of what the central government is seeking?
It's regulating culture. As, you know, mushy and conceptual as culture can be. So in addition to video games, private education has undergone some major reforms. Private education was hyper-competitive because Chinese parents really value education. So they were willing to pay a lot of extra money for after-school tutoring and after-school classes. But that exacerbated social inequality because it was only families who could pay who got the best education. So this summer, China's education ministry started limiting that kind of private tutoring. They made all private education companies nonprofits in just one sweep, and they're strictly enforcing these bans on after-school classes. They're going so far as to arrest and fine people who are secretly hiring tutors. Again, just like video game ban, it hurts a lot of people because it puts them out of work, but parents for the most part support these rules because they're also exhausted trying to get their kids not to play video games, and they're tired of how competitive and expensive education had become. But wealthier parents who benefited from the system, who were willing to shell out for a $300 an hour tutor after school, they are now scrambling to find ways to cover their tracks, to continue that kind of elite access to the best teachers, and they will find ways if they have the resources. So in the end, people who are wealthy will still continue to pull ahead, but the party's idea is that that inequality at least won't be as extreme as it was before.
Emily, this is being billed under the umbrella of common prosperity. What does that actually mean?
It's a good question because it's not entirely clear. On the surface, it appears that the Communist Party is trying to return to its original socialist mission of providing a good standard of living and equal access to all of its citizens. Unfortunately, China these days has become a highly unequal place. And so there's an idea that all of these particularly private companies got really rich in China's opening and reform, that these private firms owe much of their success to the Chinese Communist Party. And so now it's time for these companies to give back to society and to help China become a more equal, wealthy place. A number of companies have seemingly volunteered to give huge donations to charity, companies like Tencent, Alibaba, Pinduoduo, this e-commerce company. But we're not sure how that money is going to be used. Zhejiang Province, historically one of China's wealthiest, has set up what it calls a common prosperity model zone that, from the brief government descriptions, makes it sound like it'll be some kind of pilot for socialist paradise. So what I'm looking for is some more details about what policies will be in place to define what common prosperity means. Does it mean more government regulation so that companies can't run away with profits? Does it mean much more government surveillance over day-to-day life? Or does it mean vast redistribution, perhaps even income or property tax, which is something that's long been debated but never implemented in China?
That is NPR's Beijing correspondent Emily Feng. In this case, joining us from Shanghai. Emily, thanks as always.
Thanks, Scott.
On Capitol Hill this week, Democratic leaders are trying to unite around a massive spending bill to fund President Biden's priorities. They're billing it as the largest remaking of the social safety net since the New Deal. Republicans are campaigning against it. They say inflation fears and a backlash against trillions more in federal spending could help them win back control of Congress in 2022. NPR's acting congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh reports on the GOP strategy.
President Biden isn't on the ballot in next year's midterms, but Republicans say his handling of the economy will be. And Biden himself is keeping the issue front and center.
When I came to office, our first job was to stop the economic bleeding. And it was the worst bleeding since Roosevelt. We passed the American Rescue Plan. That delivered shots in arms and checks in pockets and provided that extra breathing room for working families.
Those policies gave Biden high approval ratings through the early summer. But since then, his poll numbers have dropped. The messy withdrawal from Afghanistan, combined with the Delta variant, still preventing the country from getting back to normal, has shifted the political landscape. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, speaking on Fox News Radio recently, is confident Biden will be the factor.
We all know that next year will be a referendum on how you feel about this administration. Presidential approval is the coin of the realm in these off-year elections 2 years into a new administration.
In districts across the country, GOP lawmakers say inflation, higher prices for things like gas and groceries, is outweighing other issues. At a town hall in Iowa last week, Republican freshman Ashley Hinson brought up Democrats' plan to push through a $3.5 trillion package.
What we're seeing happen right now, the spending spigot has been turned on.
Republicans say the Democrats' plan, which includes expanded health care, universal pre-K, climate programs, and more, will make inflation worse. Texas Congressman Kevin Brady, the top Republican that began drafting the plan last week, railed on what it would do to the economy.
Today, Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats begin ramming through trillions of wasteful spending and crippling tax hikes that will drive prices up even higher, kill millions of American jobs, and usher in a new era of government dependency with the greatest expansion of the welfare state in our lifetime.
Dan Constan, president of the Congressional Leadership Fund, the super PAC aligned with House Republicans, says the midterms are about sending a message to the party in power. He says some voting blocks Republicans struggled with in the last election are in play.
Now that the country is governed by one party, that party has made a decided shift left. That is already turning off voters in the middle, independents, suburban voters, college-educated men.
Republicans are also focusing on the president's mishandling of the U.S. military's exit from Afghanistan. It may not be top of mind for voters next fall, but they believe it adds to a buyer's remorse about Biden.
He ran as the competence president, and this fundamentally goes at odds with that.
But for both parties, domestic policies are the centerpiece of their message to voters. Democrats point to policies they are trying to pass right now. They say things like paid family leave, elder care, and free community college would make a big difference for American families for years to come. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi.
For our economy, for our society, for our country, what the president is advocating is transformational. It's not incremental, it's transformational.
One X factor? Redistricting. It will be months before House candidates know the shape of their districts. Republicans hold an advantage in that process, no matter the state of the economy. Deirdre Walsh, NPR News.
An ABC News employee is suing the company, accusing the former top producer of Good Morning America of sexually assaulting her, and she says the network retaliated against her for reporting it. It's proving to be the first crisis for the new president of ABC News, who took over earlier this year. And let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Fulkenflik for more. Hi, David.
Hey, Tanya.
Michael Korn, the former head of Good Morning America, left the network abruptly back in April, and then these allegations emerged over the summer. What is he accused of?
He's accused in this lawsuit by an ABC News producer named Kirsten Crawford of sexual assault during a business trip to Los Angeles, according to the lawsuit. And in the course of that lawsuit, she talks about basically an unwelcome climate for women created by Korn at GMA, and draws upon also the testimony of Jill McLean, a former ABC News producer, who says that she too was sexually assaulted by Mr. Korn when I guess they worked for World News Tonight, another ABC News show. And so these are serious allegations, which I want to indicate he's strenuously denied. He's now a top executive over a fledgling news effort by the Nexstar television company.
Yeah, I want to talk more about what he's doing and where matters stand. But how has the network handled this claim? I mean, Crawford is saying that the network has retaliated against her.
Yeah, she says in a new form submitted this week to court that she was not given a continued contract, but sort of offered another month's employment, and that she's working currently without contract for the network. The network says it's not, you know, that the claims made in the suit aren't fair and that it will play these out in court, not through comments, but that it's not accurate what was played there. What is interesting, however, is that she made this complaint, as did McLean, in February through a formal internal process, but that she told George Stephanopoulos, the host and anchor of ABC's Good Morning America, about this in 2017, and that he informed management about it. That is about 4 years ago. And that nothing came of it until she filed a formal complaint, and until, in fact, the lawsuit was imminent. You know, the timing is interesting. Her complaint filed in February. In March, the president of ABC News, James Goldston, abruptly announced he was leaving. In April, Korn, the accused Good Morning America executive producer, left. And then Kimberly Godwin, a new president, was brought in.
Right. Tell us a little bit more about Godwin. I mean, this is a big thing that she now has to take on.
Yeah, it's a huge crisis for her and not one of her own making. She came in from CBS News, where she was the number two and seen as a viable candidate to become the president there. She is the first female president of ABC News, the first African-American president of ABC News, brought in, I think, to help shape the culture there. And she said she wanted a full and independent review of the allegations made by Crawford in this lawsuit. And there's been almost crickets from ABC, her parent network, and from Disney on that request. That is, Godwin has basically been left hanging there waiting to learn what her employers are going to do, and also waiting to see whether or not her newsroom will continue to follow her if she doesn't have the juice to get done what she thinks is necessary.
In addition to all of what Crawford is alleging, she's also saying that she formally registered her complaint with ABC and they didn't renew her contract. Michael Korn, going back to him, I mean, he denies any wrongdoing, as you said, but he's still working in the industry. So where do matters stand?
Well, so this is obviously in court. Nexstar, which is a local news giant, hired him to oversee what will be a national newscast, News Nation. They say this is about matters that preceded his employment there, and so they're not really commenting upon it. This is likely to play out in court. I think that, you know, what is interesting is that ABC sort of avoided the huge scandals we saw in the immediate aftermath of the eruption of Me Too claims at places like NBC News with Matt Lauer, at CBS with Les Moonves, the chairman, and Charlie Rose, the famous host and anchor there, you know, affected NPR to some degree as well. This is really ABC's moment in the spotlight to question of whether or not it is handling it well now. And what happened in those 4 years between 2017 and this year? Why was it that after such a distinguished figure as George Stephanopoulos elevated this to management, to executives who are supposed to handle this, why is it that the network didn't address it seriously? And what are the truth of the allegations, of course? Those have yet to be proven in court.
Right. Those are really big questions. What else are you watching for or following as you report on this?
Well, I think that, you know, ABC as a network has been waiting to see whether its culture will be changed as well. They had questions raised about leadership back in Burbank, and Peter Rice was brought in to help Disney move forward as it absorbed a lot of Fox's old things. And I think also that, you know, Godwin's role as the first African-American leading ABC News, a real outsider brought in to lead ABC News, is an unusual figure in its history. And whether or not she'll be able to get past this crisis controversy is, I think, something we're going to watch closely.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflicht, as always, thank you so much.
You bet.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Scott Tong. It's Here and Now.